These are the Target Files, taking a 21st century look back at the 20th century adventures of the Doctor in novelization and audiobook form, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, "There's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time."
Hello there, welcome to the Target Files, episode 55, and this is part 2 of the Stephen Moffat hit or miss episode, where we're going to discuss the Empty Child, Doctor Dances, which is the second part of that episode, and Time of the Doctor.
Hi, this is Mike in Swansea.
And hi, this is Alex in Exeter.
Yes, would you like to cue us up with the first story we're going to talk about today, Al?
Well, we're going to discuss The Empty Child, which is the first ever one Stephen Moffat did for Doctor Who, new Doctor Who. And it's basically a bit of a sort of a mixture of Victorian romp meets sort of space galactic heist. And it brings in the great character of Captain Jack Harkness, played by the great John Barrowman, fantastically. And it has lots of sort of fun child. It's set in World War II, so it's children urchins. It's just fantastically shot, basically. And then it has the curveball of adding a sort of alien child sort of taking over and becoming very ill and ending up with these sort of very scary gas masks.
Yes, I've got it playing in the background with the sound off and the subtitles on here, Al. So if we just sort of go through it, it's got to that very first scene where the Doctor and Rose are chasing the capsule to Earth. A lot of great camp humour from Moffat about a great line, first of all, about it being a mauve alert. And Rose says, "What's about red alert? You know, what's the matter with red alert and the rest of the universe?" And the Doctor jokes, "Oh, that's just so camp, really, all those lights."
No, I don't. Can you not get any more camp with the whole mauve thing? It's very funny.
Yeah, so that's straight into Moffat's humour. I actually watched The Curse of the Fatal Death, the previous TV Doctor Who. Not really canon, that he did for comic relief before this in 1999. And there's definitely elements of that sort of throwback and self-awareness humour of the Doctor here.
Oh, definitely. That is a very fun thing he did for comic relief. And the sort of, the Doctor's, I think, because you've had a few series. Is this after Dalek? This one I never remember.
Yeah, Dalek and then The Long Game, isn't it?
Yeah, you've had quite a few serious sort of Doctor stories where he's quite, you know, Christopher Eccleston being brilliant, but he's quite dark and very serious. Well, this one is serious still. There's lots of stuff that goes on in these two episodes, but I think there's more of a lighter humour, sort of more funny stuff what Moffat can do really well in these two.
And I've got to mention now, as they're stepping out of the TARDIS, Al, probably the most cosplayed version of the Doctor and Ninth Rose that you see at various conventions, the wonderful Union Jack top she's wearing.
Well, it's just so easy to cosplay. I think that's why, you know, all, you know, exists, you can get those t-shirts anywhere in England. So I think it was a very clever idea there to have a Union Jack t-shirt, because it's just new, it could be sort of cosplayed very easily.
The great line from Captain Jack about being inconspicuous, she says, "You know, it looks good on you, Rose, the Union Jack top, but really, U-boat captain, Doctor?"
I think that's, isn't that in the first episode where she's sort of hanging from the Barrett's balloon?
Well, it's later on when the three of them meet up in the hospital.
Oh, in the hospital thing.
Talking about what they've been doing, basically. But yeah, Rose spots a mysterious-looking child on a rooftop calling out for its mummy.
Which is very scary. I find that top very scary still. It's very cleverly done. It's not a great deal, is it? It's just a child in a gas mask.
It's just everything, the way it's shot, the lighting. I think James Hawes directed this one.
really clever, because the whole concept of the episode is a child in a gas mask, but which, you know, on the front of it isn't very scary. Once you add that sort of "Are You My Mummy" and all that sort of Silent Hill stuff to it, it becomes very scary.
Sort of relatively easy to follow in the plot, you know. There have been criticisms of Stephen later on in his era, the complications within the plot, but he's not really sort of talking on a target basis. You know, we'd hope to see this book novelised one day, and perhaps with the new versions, we, if they're a success, we might get further stories such as this one done. It's possibly a little bit more paint by numbers of Stephen, this one, but there's still so many layers within that.
Yeah, there is layers, but there's a, I will agree, there's a lot more, you know, this happens in this first episode, I think.
Yes, and then we get the introduction of the now iconic Captain Jack, quite subdued compared to his later appearances at first when he's within this sort of gentleman's club within London in the middle of a blitz.
Yeah, it's a very different Captain Jack to what you get, the sort of very bold, you know, Captain Jack at the late and tortured Captain Jack. I think it's a much more captain, you know, that's all captain in the army. It's very much, well, there's still major elements of John Barrowman's personality there.
Pretty amusingly, on the commentary, you get both John Barrowman and Stephen Moffat on the DVD release of Series 1, and on the Blu-ray version they brought out, upscaled. I think John or Stephen himself joked that it was actually a gay club opened in the middle of London during the Blitz.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. I watched that commentary as well. It's hilarious.
So it would stand out slightly, wouldn't it, amongst the fact you wouldn't want to be keeping your lights on that time period?
No, not at all. No, I just think this episode moves very, very slickly from that to the next bit, which is sort of moves on very. Do you meet the sort of children and Nancy? I think the next bit, isn't it?
And yes, the idea of Blitz Kids, based on history, apparently. I've got the Doctor Who magazine here, which did a fact or fiction section on this story. It is issue 480, which was out in the winter of 2014 and 15. And they've included a paragraph in the fact of fiction about the Blitz Kids. Somebody, a writer called Stuart Hilton, wrote Their Darkest Hour in 2001, where he speculated as many as 80,000 school children were running wild in London by the end of 1940 because all the schools had been shut. And it's such a cleverly laid element into the story, isn't it?
Oh, it's a really, that statistic doesn't surprise me, but it's a really clever bit where, you know, they're around the table, they're eating the stolen stuff, and then suddenly the doctor's there, and it works really well, that scene.
And just as with Matt, and with Peter, certainly in the later series now, and David, you get the doctor's real sort of bond with children, don't you?
Oh, definitely. You know, I think there's that thing with the doctor where he doesn't see children as beneath him, he sees them as the same as him, really. So there's a great shots in this, and as we said with David and Peter, and, you know, you just get that element of children are part of the Who world now, so I think it's a good thing.
The you know, bit of humour saying, what are the police going to do if they find you? They're going to arrest you for starving.
Exactly. It's like, you know, big sort of things going under the surface here, really, what Stephen Moffat's trying to get through with that whole, like, what are they going to do? You're starving, they're not going to arrest you. So it's all, you know, nick and eat as much as possible, basically.
Yes, we get a wonderful actress, shame we've not seen her in more TV since, called Florence Hoth, playing Nancy, the young girl who's really got a heart of gold, and she's going out on the Blitz and finding all these newly laid tables for the starving children to eat from.
Yes, he was really good in both these two episodes, because he's really important to the second episode as well. And it's like, it's a shame she hasn't done more, because I thought she was really good, and she's sort of got that nerve to go out and blitz and find food, you know, and find ways of getting food for these starving children, really.
The first sort of iconic meeting of Rose and Captain Jack. Jack's Tula warship saving her midair, and he starts to unpeel his layers and really become the sort of flirtatious, the king of flirtation, really, that he's become ever since.
Oh, most definitely. Some great sort of flirtating sort of scenes between him and Rose, and that bit with, you know, they're on the balcony and it's sort of champagne. It's all very, very flirty, which is total Captain Jack now, really, what he's become, really.
Yeah, and Rose is absolutely totally in love with him, isn't she? Totally in awe. Billy plays that almost like a wide-eyed sort of puppy, doesn't she?
Oh, totally. She thinks he's brilliant, you know, because she's only met the Doctor, and then she meets this other sort of space pirate sort of captain who basically does everything more than the Doctor would.
Yes, and then it's back to the meal that the children out on the streets have been brought to by Nancy with the Doctor, and we get the gas mask child appearing outside, and it's a wonderful light touch the way it's directed into a real sort of horror scene, isn't it, as the child's trying to get into the house.
That's great, that bit, isn't it? Is that also the bit where it has the ringing phone?
Yes.
Yeah, that phone is so sort of scary, and it so sort of reminds me a bit on the video game Silent Hill. It's sort of so just really sort of little touches with the phone and the knocking door and you know, the doctor not knowing what to do and thinking it will come in the house, basically. It's just, there's these really little things work so well in this episode.
Jumping forward a little bit, we get a wonderful shot of Jack and Rose in front of Big Ben. I think, well, they discussed on the commentary, Stephen Moffat and John Barrowman, about how the Big Ben sign wasn't moving, but was it actually switched off in the war in case it was targeted by the Germans?
I have a feeling that it was, it's been switched off now for repair, but I think it was switched off in the Second World War for that reason.
Yeah, but it still looks very much a bit of backward protection, unfortunately, doesn't it, in the story?
Yeah, it's one of the little things, what you know, like they've also mentioned, like the photoshopping, it doesn't actually quite work, unfortunately.
And then we sort of move forward a little bit again. We end up within the Albion Hospital, which was a throwback to the Aliens of London episode where we saw it in the modern 2000s, earlier on in the Eccleston series.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think about that. It's the same hospital. It looks very different to what it does later in the future episode. But it's sort of building towards meeting, you know, the one doctor who's left for it. I think it works really well when you see all the patients are turning into the zombies, really.
Yes, we meet the Dr. Constantine. And could you actually believe who played him?
It was the great Richard Wilson, wasn't it? He was so well done in that role.
Yeah, you know, how do you feel about the CGI looks nowadays? I think the way it's lit, I think it... The story is so good, it sort of just pulls you in, you know? I suppose you could find, if you were very... very technically minded, you could find certain things wrong with it, but that whole idea with the music as well, the lighting, the direction is so horrific, the idea of the gas mask growing out of the face.
I think it really works. I agree, you could be a bit picky, there are some sort of not as good as it could be, but I think that the way the gas mask and all the patients suddenly turn into zombies really works. Well, I found it frightening when I watched it first time.
We get the meeting of Captain Jack and the Doctor for the first time. Jack mentions he's got a squareness gun and that he picked it up in a certain planet called Villengard, which apparently is a throwback now, will be appearing when the first and 12th Doctors visit it in Twice Upon a Time. So that's an interesting throwback to this story.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I didn't know that. That's, is that the planet where these sort of glass crystal villains are going to come from in the Christmas special?
I think so, because the Doctor actually mentions to Jack about Villengard. Jack says he only went there, you know, the once to pick up things, and the Doctor then immediately says, yes, I only needed to go there once, obviously alluding to the fact he was the one who destroyed it.
Yeah. Isn't it the whole thing about bananas, that scene?
Yeah, when they use a squareness gun, but the Doctor's done a lovely little magic switch, so he gets to use the squareness gun, which blows a hole in the wall and then manages to seal it again.
There's some lovely bits in those scenes between Jack and Chris Eccleston's Doctor. There's some fun bits with the whole, you know, why have you got a screwdriver? I've got a gun sort of thing.
And then we move towards the denouement of this first episode with a cliffhanger anyway. What did you make of that, Al? The idea of these people whose faces have been turned into gas-masked zombies marching slowly towards people. It's quite reminiscent, really, of the most recent The Doctor Falls, isn't it? With the Cybermen doing the same thing within a hospital setting.
Yeah, there is a lot of similarity, I think, between this episode and The Doctor Falls, the whole hospital thing. But I think that sort of, when they all started turning into zombies and he sort of backed himself into a corner, was really sort of a good cliffhanger to be left on for about a week, it was, and sort of wondering would they get out of that sort of thing. So I think at the time it worked really well, as we were sort of in new season where we weren't, well, I was perfectly happy. I think a lot of people still wanted 4 or 5 episode stories.
And it's a fairly, you know, simple idea to sort it out by the Doctor just sort of saying, you go to your room.
Yeah, well, it's the way Chris says it, and it just works so well. You know, sort of that, what do you do with a child? Send it to his room and it works. Well, it doesn't work, unfortunately.
And then I like the way that is spun on its head then when the Doctor says, I told you to go to your room, but it's actually the room where they're managing to use a radio communication.
Yeah, and they're actually stuck in the room he wants to be in, so it sort of makes it even worse.
Yeah, a lovely bit of old technology there. The reel-to-reel tape machines.
Oh, they're just great. There's very lots of little details in these two episodes, what just works so well, I think.
Yeah, and it's slowly being unravelled, the whole mystery of it, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. There's not... It's not, I don't think it's a pacey episode, but I think there's so much in it, but it actually does go very quickly, I think.
Yes, and then we get the idea of Nancy is the character played by Florence Hoth, being caught by a gentleman, whose food she's just gone to get in the house. And she mentions the line about him messing around with a butcher, and that's how he gets all these extra things in the time of rationing.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, it's that sort of early period where, you know, sort of Doctor Who added extra sort of layers to it and those sort of things.
Yes, I've just noticed, Al, that you were correct about it being in the second episode, the banana and the squareness.
Oh, is it? Is it? I thought it was.
The very beginning of the second episode, yeah.
Yeah.
That's where we've got to now. Possibly a little bit of a lull in the story then, as they get towards the grand finale.
Yeah, I think it's one of these things that might have been able to be done in one episode instead of two. Unfortunately,
I'm not sure. You know, I think there's enough there. Enough.
You mean there's enough? I think there's enough sort of background story. But I just wonder, is it one that could have been done in one? No, I like the second episode as well for lots of bits.
Yeah, and then we get sort of Captain Jack disappearing again. People realising that he's more of a con man, really, than anything else he's claimed to be so far.
Yeah, you get that sort of big sort of connection to the CSI, isn't it? The sort of criminal agency he works for, which he comes all out in Torchwood in later times.
Yes, and elements of kindness being shown in his character as we get towards the end. He does actually teleport the Doctor and Rose, doesn't he, out of a tricky situation.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's the really interesting with Captain Jack. It takes an awful long time. I think it takes near the end of season two of Torchwood to you actually find out an awful lot about him. So he's sort of all over the place. Can he be kind? Can he be dark? It sort of really works.
Yes, and we get, of course, the three of them at Barry Railway Station at night. Apparently this was a budget necessity. They had to rewrite the ending to this story. It was apparently supposed to be set in the daytime, which seems so unusual now because it's such an atmospheric nighttime setting. I can't really
imagine
that at all.
Is it nighttime setting, that last shot in the train there? That works much better than nighttime.
Yeah, and then we get the Jack looking to distract Algy. And there's a bit of a question about, the first sort of question comes in about, with the innuendo in the title as well, about Jack's sexuality, doesn't it? You know, he says that. Or somebody, one of them asks Rose to go and distract one of the guards, and Jack turns around and says, he's not really your type.
I know, it's sort of, because we're still in the sort of early, you know, it's a Stephen Moffat episode, it's actually still got all the elements of Russell's theories on life and that. So there were lots of little moments with Jack and, you know, sort of putting those sort of issues over, which are great.
Yeah, it's pretty groundbreaking at the time, you know, back in the finale of that first season, you had Captain Jack planting a kiss on the Doctor's lips, and that was pretty groundbreaking at the time, wasn't it? You know, less than sort of, if you consider the environment at the time, less than 10 years after a lot of fuss about the Doctor kissing a female in the TV movie.
Oh, I know, totally, and, you know, it's just ridiculous, you know, things have changed, thank God, by then, but it's sort of still making a bit of a fuss, I think, you know, that last scene. Well, I also think, you couldn't say anything, because you have the scene of the Trini and Susanna robots that last episode, where he's butt naked, so it sort of goes its way, really.
Yeah, like him, really. each and every alien way around the world, the pansexual.
Definitely. If you've read or listened to any of the new Torchwood stuff that's out there, it's gone very much more that way.
I think it's pansexual is the phrase that
pansexual is what he's meant to be. He's definitely
that.
He's
appropriated that phrase for the sci-fi world, didn't they? The fact he visits all these different alien planets and has lots of stories about what he's got up to.
Definitely. And as we know, the new Torchwood box sets or Big Finish has done recently, they are very pansexual.
Yes, and poor old Algy, really.
He goes in
to distract him, and he gets the gas mask treatment straight away.
Straight away, he sort of straight turned into a zombie, and he's like, oh, poor guy.
And poor old Nancy has been locked up, hasn't she? And next to a guy who has become zombie, but she's managed to apparently get out of it by singing a lullaby.
That gets her out of it, doesn't it? That's right, because it's sort of that sort of hope, because it's, you know, you get to the end bit, we're getting to the end bit, and it's like Nancy's most important act, really.
That's the setup, isn't it, really? The first sort of elements of what's coming. Which I remember it being quite a surprise at the end. I wasn't really expecting her to be... Spoilers, folks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. She is the mother of the child rather than the sister, as she claims earlier on.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice twist when we got to the end, and that whole, you know, it was her son, she's the mother, and it's all very connected nice to that bit. And then I thought the nanobots bit was great at the end.
Lovely conversation where Rose... lets it be known that, you know, we will win the war in Britain. It's a beautifully acted, well-directed, well-written moment, that.
That's brilliant. What you think, that's also a connection to this Christmas where, you know, the Doctor tells the captain, played by Mark Gatiss, what was going to be a Second World War.
Fast-forwarding on a little bit more. Captain Jack has done a bit of a runner, really.
Yeah, he sort of tries to go off in his sort of space, you know, once the con's gone wrong, doesn't he? He sort of tries to get away, but then changes his mind, I think, if I remember so right.
And we get the big reveal. Spoilers, folks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That nanotechnology has been behind all this. And remembering back in those days in the mid-2000s, Al, you were starting to get more sort of stories about the benefits of nanotechnology, weren't we? I mean,
it was everywhere back then, and it sort of seems to have vanished. But it's very interesting to see what the Holby City character Paul McGann is playing is buried into nanotechnology and stem cell technology.
It all comes back to who, folks?
It does.
The negative side of that is, of course, stories about war, isn't it? And that's sort of presumed when we see nanotechnology earlier on in the story, but it's a really nice sort of denouement ending that it's actually used to sort of heal people.
Yeah, I think it's a really good idea, and the fact the Doctor, you know, has seen so much in the Time War horror, and he gets this chance to put one day right, and Chris Eccleston does that so well, that scene.
What's become a bit of a meme for the Moffat era, really, everybody lives. You know, it seems to have happened with Clara now, and it looks like it'll happen with Bill.
Yeah, so we must discuss the, do we think it's right that Bill's coming back or not?
Yeah, we'll discuss that towards the end of the story, Al. Yeah. But yes, everything is nicely sorted out and wrapped up. And we get the wonderful lines about an old lady saying to Dr. Constantine that her leg has grown back.
That is a nice shot between her and Chris Wilson.
What's his response as well? You know, it is a war. Is it possible you miscount? These
things change.
Yes, and so we got Nancy reunited with what is her son. A lovely moment of joy. Eccleston did the lighter moments really well as well, didn't he? Considering Doctor he was.
He's just really good at, you know, I don't know what it is, Chris Eccleston, but he can flip between light and dark in a second, and he does it so well. I think in this episode there's lots of little tones of darkness, but there's more light, because I think we've had a bit of dark two episodes before this that were pretty dark, so I think there's more comedy. It works so well, I think.
And taking us back, a bit of a camp ending to go with the idea of the camp alert at the beginning of episode one, we get the euphemism of the Doctor dancing and the Doctor saying, which one of us does Captain Jack want to dance with, Rose?
Yeah, probably both.
He can take his time. He's lived a long life if he is going to be the old face of Beau.
Indeed. That was another good thing in Series 2, sort of wrapping all that up.
And you probably never thought you'd see Christopher Eccleston dancing, but I think he did enjoy the variations in the role. He was always known as a very intense actor. He still is, really, since Who.
Oh, definitely, definitely. It's like, in the A-word, what he's in right at the moment. He can do comedy, he can do hardcore acting. It's just brilliant. And, you know, there's some real fun bits, like the dancing bit and the campness. It just lightens up, I think.
So, yes, Al, it sounds like it's going to be a hit for you as well. Do you want to say why it's a hit and how it's stood up for you after these, 12 and a half years now since first broadcast?
I think it's a hit for me because it's one of the Stephen Moffat ones that doesn't get bogged down in a lot of either scientific waffle or sort of stuff. It's a really clever, nice start to finish story, but I think it could have been put into one instead of two, but I like it as two, and I think there's some really nice moments, and I think there's some really fun sort of camp bits as well that have come over quite fun. So, and of course, you got, you know, if you hadn't had this episode, you wouldn't have got any of the torture at all Captain Jack stuff, so I think it's definitely a hit.
Yeah, stranger thing, isn't it? You know, RTD is so sort of wrapped up with Torchwood, but Stephen's actually the first person to write for Captain Jack when he first appeared. I think Russell gave him the brief. And Chris Chibnall was the one who sort of produced most of the Torchwood episodes, really, so it's strange how it's sort of almost seen as a purely RTD creation.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, the way they Big Finish have taken Captain Jack, it's still, I think the four boxes they found out at the moment, so like maybe season six, are all from Russell T Davies' ideas, but being written and scripted by Scott Hancock, so it's still that sort of idea, I think.
And does this, seeing Billy and the Ninth Doctor back again, really want you to have had more? Does it really make you wish we'd had just perhaps one more series of them?
I think it would have been so nice to have one more season of Chris, because he had it. He had it from the get-go of, you know, what his Doctor was going to be, and I think there was plenty more room before he got to David Tennant.
Hopefully Big Finish keep plugging away, keep asking him. Oh, hopefully
they keep asking him every year, and he keeps saying no. David Tennant they can get whenever they like, it's just due to his schedule.
Well, it took Tom until nearly his 80s, didn't it? So keep plugging away, please.
Yeah, it took Tom nearly ever. We'll see.
This is Alex Gibbon's Doctor Who News Round.
Hello, this is Alex, and this is Who's News on the 8th of December. First thing to mention is that today a new trailer for Twice Upon a Time has been launched, the fantastic Christmas episode of Doctor Who. So have a look at that and let us know what you think. It's meant to have nice shots of regeneration oil coming out of Peter, so it should be fun. Also been announced by the BBC is that it's going to be an hour and it's on at 5:30 on Christmas Day. Doctor Who has also decided for season 11 to use the most highest lenses you can get for cameras. These are anamorphic lenses, what give a very, very sharp cinema outlook on all footage, and will hopefully give it a 4K look. So they're going to look like little mini films, which is going to make it look stunning. From BigFinish.com, they have announced that they are going to do the British crime ITV drama Callum, which is going to be 4 different episodes as a box set. It's going to star Ben Miles as Callum and Frank Skinner as his partner. We're also going to have lots of other really famous actors. So second thing to mention, from Big Finish next year, which is not going to be out until October, but well worth waiting for, is one of their short trips reigns, written and read by Jeffrey Beavers, and it's called I Am the Master. So that's to give you an idea of what it's about. It should be rather interesting. To celebrate the 40th anniversary of Blake 7, which is in January, Big Finish are doing 2 separate box sets. One is called The Way Ahead and the other is Crossfire. Should be very interesting. So, Mike, we now move on to The Miss, which is Time of the Doctor, Matt Smith's final episode as the Doctor. What were your feelings on it?
Overall, a bit stuttered out. Some great moments. One amazingly great moment at the very last scene. I don't know what it was. You know, at the time, I have rewatched it again, found a few more positive things about it. But the fact it came straight after that wonderful Day of the Doctor, just a month after, it was the end of Matt at the time, and at that point, I didn't really want him to go. Although I was looking forward to seeing Peter Capaldi, I have the same situation now. I don't want Peter to go, but I'm looking forward to seeing Jodie. So a bit stuttering as a story, I found, Al. You know, a lot of things tied up from the Moffat era quite quickly. But if we sort of go through that one from the beginning again, should we just talk along as it goes along?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I'm like you with it. I think it sort of has good bits and it has a lot of stuttering.
Yeah, it's a nice sort of good bit of bonhomie, a good jolly Christmas start, really. A lot of humour there. The Doctor out in the stars. Sorry, we do get a voiceover first from Orla Brady, who played Tasha Lem, the psycho nun, as she's described by Clara later on in the story, talking about the Doctor protecting a planet. And then we see him with his new companion at the time, who is a Cyberman head called Handles. I think, did he come from that Neil Gaiman story? Was it Nightmare in Silver?
Yeah, I do believe he did come from that. He's sort of part two with that, I think. It's sort of, I think, doesn't the whole Tasha Lynn stuff come first? He gets involved with going to the sort of priesthood.
Yeah, well, first of all, pre-titles is juxtaposed between Clara cooking Christmas dinner for her mum, her dad, and her nan, although the actress playing her dad seems to have changed hugely since the series earlier that year, which is a bit jarring.
Yeah, I think they picked a different actor. It's a bit weird. You think they would have kept with the same actors and actors. I think her nan's played very well, though, in it.
Juxtaposed against the Doctor meeting some Cybermen up in the stars there, and Matt Smith wearing a pretty awful wig, because we know he had the long gap after filming Series 7 and came back for this special. And he'd actually done a film with, who was the actor? Was it Ryan Gosling? Directed by Ryan Gosling, and he'd gone bald for that, hadn't he?
Yeah, he had the complete shaved head, and they made this great. Didn't they make this sort of great connection of getting rid of the wig because it's where he hid the TARDIS key or something like that? Wasn't
yeah, that occurs a little bit later on in the story, doesn't it? But you know, we get the Doctor coming around for Christmas dinner after the titles, meeting the Gran, and the whole joke is apparently that he wears hollow clothes in the TARDIS and he turns up naked.
Yeah, so no, it's a bit of a weird one, but it's great. It sort of works a little bit, this sort of joke then. It's sort of, you know, the Nan's finding him sexy. So it sort of works.
And the Nan actress, of course, first name Sheila. I can't think of the second name, but she appeared in Vengeance and Varos in the classic series.
Of course.
Part of the married couple who were watching a lot of reality TV on Varos the planet.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, she's a very good actress.
And she puts it down to the Doctor's nakedness, down to him being Swedish, of course. Bit of a stereotype there, did you find out?
Yeah, a little bit. I find that whole bit, you know, a bit jarring, to be honest. It's not the greatest.
And then we get this revelation of the planet, which the plot is to do with a lot of the Doctor's enemies have heard a signal called Doctor Who coming through the cosmos, and they've gathered around this planet, and Handel's translates the planet as being Gallifrey to him.
Yeah, and it sort of isn't Gallifrey. It's another place called Heaven, is I think they call it, and it's sort of. I think there's a very, because it's Christmas, you have to throw in a few sort of allegorical things, I think. So it sort of, it works, but it doesn't work, I think.
No, does it actually turn out to be Trenzalore, of course, which was set up in the...
They call it Heaven, but I think we eventually find out it is Trenzalore. It is where he's meant to die, basically.
And they go there, of course, via the papal mainframe.
This is a very interesting thing. It's like a ship that's built on papal nuns and basically sex, basically. That's the whole outlook of it. And sort of the whole that scene, the Doctor is flirting the whole time, basically.
Yeah, he can't help himself, can he, in the modern era?
I know, it's like, you know, the whole of that scene, you know, it's really great because you've got Aura Brayley basically playing the head, you know, Tassia Lynn, and she's fantastic in that scene. But it's like, it's flirting and wanting too many sweets, basically, the whole of that scene is.
Yeah, and do you see that the whole setup really of the papal mainframe is to explain the idea of what was her name, Madame Kavarian, wasn't it, the one who sent River?
Prepared
River as a child to kill the Doctor.
Well, I think that's the theory, but it doesn't get really explained. And that's what I'm hoping in the new Riversong books coming from Big Finish, where they're going to have her back. It's all going to get explained.
Oh, is Kavarian coming back? Or
Madame Kavarian, Frankie Barber, is coming back for the next season of The Diaries of Riversong.
Yes, they're seen as being as part of the same chapter, aren't they?
I think so, but like you, I didn't think it was very well explained.
And another thing well explained was the appearance of the Silence. You know, I'm struggling to understand why they were there, really, or perhaps I just forgot seeing them, Al.
Well, it's probably the case, you know, if you're not meant to see them, you blink and don't... What? Yeah, why were the... I think the Silence are meant to be because they're like papal assassin monks, aren't they? I think they're somehow related to all that sort of religious bit.
Yeah, and they were two sort of main issues from the Matt era, really, which were being tidied up by Moffat. But I suppose he could have left it a bit later, considering he stayed on to see Capaldi in the role.
Oh, definitely. But I think that was more connected to Matt's sort of era than Capaldi's. It's like the whole papal main thing didn't really work for me. Don't it look? It's a fantastic set.
Yeah, fantastic CGI as well, isn't it? And the Doctor tries to get down onto the planet with a TARDIS key. You know, he's being teleported down there. And as you said, the idea of the wig is brought in here, and he's hidden an extra key underneath it.
Oh yeah, so it's to explain why, you know, Matt Smith is bald, and it sort of semi works. It's jokey and it's fun. It's sort of, I think because it's Christmas Day, though it is Matt Smith's last episode, it was quite, you know, laughy, jokey. There wasn't much sort of seriousness to the end bit.
And we get a bit of horror, you know, for Christmas Day with Clara getting her ankle attached to by a weeping angel.
Oh yeah, that bit's really good. There's also the other horror bits, you know, where Tassia Lynn starts turning into a Dalek later. This is quite nasty, I thought.
Yeah, and then you get the whole idea that they've got past this shield, apparently, that Tasha Lem has set up.
Yeah, I just think there's too much going on, or this is not enough explained. That's the problem I have with this episode.
Yeah, just trying to remember how they got past the Weeping Angels, but that was to do with the TARDIS key being underneath his wig and it materialising.
I think there was something to do with that, wasn't there? She manages to get her foot out eventually.
And I cannot look at Matt Smith with bald head without thinking Lex Luthor.
Yeah, the was he the guy, Jesse...
Yeah, he's actually got hair, isn't he, in part of the new films that have come out, the Superman versus
Batman.
Well,
the last shot in Justice League, is completely bald. When you see Lex Luthor, it's the only shot he's in Justice League, he's completely bald.
And a nice actor I've met at Comic-Con called Michael Rosenbaum, who played him in Smallville.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, and then we get... a guest actress from Only Fools and Horses here in the UK, of course, Tessa Peake Jones, showing them that there's a truth field in this little village they've arrived at called Christmas. And you get
yes, I didn't recognise it was her, but she's very good.
And that wonderful introduction of Clara was showing how self-aware Moffat is, really, isn't he? Saying she's a bit of a runaway teacher who's a bit of a control freak. And then she puts her hand over her mouth.
Oh, exactly. She can be a bit like that sometimes. That's the greatness of Gemma, though.
I think there's great self-awareness of the characters in Moffat's Who, isn't it? Because I was going to mention, I forgot to in the earlier part when we spoke about The Empty Child, how Rose mentions that the Doctor, when he gets panicky, he starts to remind everybody how clever he is and puts lots of other species down.
Yeah, there's just always, I think, when Steve Moffat is writing good, there's always those little bits of, you know, background to the Doctor or background to the Companion. It gives you so much more, I think.
And there's another little line there from Clara. How can a... town be called Christmas, and Matt Smith turns around and says, how can an island be called Easter?
Exactly.
People have noticed those Easter Island statues do look a lot like Matt Smith's face.
Yeah, they do a bit.
Let's see, the chinny chin.
The chinny chin. I just think it's trying to keep, because it's Christmas Day, this episode can be a bit fluffy.
And we get the reappearance of something we've not seen since Amy Pond left, and that's the crack in the wall owl, which pays off later in the episode.
It does. Are you like me thinking that crack in the wall is a bit of an easy way out?
Yes, I think so. I did like the idea when they brought it back of the Doctor. I think it was an episode we actually saw at Regeneration's convention with a crowd owl, wasn't it? When he's stuck in the hotel, is it the God Complex? And he looked through to see the thing the Doctor most fears, and it is that crack, isn't it?
Yeah, and that worked, but I don't know. I think it started to get a bit overused, that crack, by this.
Yes, indeed. You know, and I think Matt is relishing the role again in this story. Possibly restrained because he knows the end is coming.
Yeah, but I think there are some great bits with Matt in this episode. You know, when they make him older, and you know he's having to look after that village for so many years. There's some great bits there, and the whole regen's in at the end is fantastic.
Yeah, I've been rewatching the first Capaldi series this week in preparation. I'm doing all his era again before we get to Christmas.
And, well, that's tempting. I should do that. Well, I don't have season 10 yet.
There is a definite shift change, I think, in Clara. She does become more like the Doctor herself by the end of Capaldi's first run. But she's very much in this sort of assistant role, I suppose, at this point still.
Yeah, I think definitely. She's definitely asking a lot of questions throughout this. And I would agree. In the first season, season 8 of Capaldi's era, it's like... she's very in control, and she wants, you know, because she gets a new partner, doesn't she? And it's all leads very much when at the end. I would agree, there's a difference in the way she plays Clara. I think it's better.
But am I possibly mistaken, because she is put in such a vulnerable situation in this story, and that the Doctor sends her away as he did with Rose in the Ninth Doctor era, of course, because he wants her to be safe and sound and not having to fight for what turns out to be centuries on Trenzalore.
Yeah, I think there is that reason there as well, why her companion is slightly different, you know, because it's like she still thinks it's going to be years of adventures and fun, you know, and it's not that way, unfortunately.
No, and then, of course, we get Clara sent back to the modern day, and the Doctor announces that he's the sheriff, and we get the wonderful Orla Brady again giving us a bit of narration about how the Doctor protects this planet for a very long time.
Yeah, I thought that was some really nice shots. So you get lots of all the old villains coming in for that bit. You get like Cybermen, you get Daleks, you get Weeping Angels, you get Silence. It all works really well. And it's quite compact, because you'd think that sort of shot would take a while. With the sort of narration, understanding, it works well, I think. And then do we get back to Clara when she's having the Christmas dinner? You get that absolutely beautiful poem her Nan reads out.
Yes, just before that, before she returns... to Trenzalore a few hundred years later, I think. Yeah, we get a lovely montage of the Doctor fighting Wooden Cyberman, which was very interesting at the time.
Yeah, because they, I can never remember, the modern sort of Cybermen, aren't they?
Yeah, and then the Doctor sort of complaining more about Clara clinging to the TARDIS, you know, I think only the second person to do that after Captain Jack did it in Utopia, I think the episode was.
Well, the third person, if we include himself, from Day of the Doctor,
Oh, of course, yes. Yeah. And but he's sort of more interested in the TARDIS at the time when he first sees her, isn't he? Saying, okay, now, no wonder she took so long to bring you back.
Definitely. It's, and there's a lovely thing, because Matt's made up to be really old when he comes back in that bit, and it just works really well.
He does. He does the old man acting pretty well. You can never quite convince people with the eyes, though. You know, age is seen through the eyes as well, isn't it? And there's that sort of uncanny valley effect of just the old makeup, the old wrinkles on the face, but the eyes never look that old.
No, but I was just thinking there, the one where it did work was Colin Morgan, who played Merlin.
Right, I didn't ever see that one. I don't think there
was a couple of episodes where he was made to be like the old Merlin, and that looked, he looked really old when he did him.
Yeah, so maybe a bit of a improvement since those days, really. And then we get the lovely scene to see how the Doctor's made his time making toys for people, and lots of people have drawn him pictures, and that's a sort of real shout out to fandom of all ages, isn't it, I think?
Oh, definitely, because they probably were made by fans, and all these lovely little pictures of the TARDIS and that, and those toys are beautiful, what he makes for people.
Yes, absolutely. And then we get the chat up on the clock tower, don't we, about regeneration, and he mentions how David Tennant's one used a bit of energy to reinvigorate himself, didn't he? And then he calls him Captain Grumpy. You're forgetting Captain Grumpy, old John Hurt's War Doctor.
Oh, this is brilliant. Yeah, there's that great, from that clock scene onwards, there's some really brilliant shots between between Matt Smith and Gemma, and all that sort of bringing, you know, the Daleks are trying to kill him still. It just works really well.
Well, tenderness really there, isn't it, between them, I think?
Oh, definitely, because he sort of thinks, you know, this is it, I can't regenerate any longer, and it's like some beautiful scenes between him and Gemma.
You change your face, and he mentions about, you know, the Tennant using up that energy, silly Tennant. And Captain Grumpy, he calls it still a regeneration.
Well, some way, it is a regeneration with the Captain Grumpy. What, you know, I'd love to see more of that, but we didn't. It's sort of, yeah, there's some, you know, sort of very interesting bits about regeneration in this thing, I think.
Yeah, did it sort of stick out for you more, this regeneration, because we knew Matt was the youngest? Has it been a good idea? You know, was it just partially so we can have Big Finish in the future that he gave him such a long gap on Trenzalore?
Maybe. I think, I'm not too sure with that. You know, though I love Peter Capaldi, I would have still liked more Matt Smith, because I just thought he was just getting in. You know, it takes a while. I think this whole 3-year turnaround now isn't the greatest idea, because it takes about 2 seasons to actually get into your Doctor, I think.
I suppose so, but you know, back in the 70s, up to 81, Tom was more or less the one who distorted it, wasn't he, really? Because he gave us this idea of you could stay for 7 years because he embodied it so much.
Yeah, I get that, and that was great with Tom, but it's like, I just think, but the problem is at the moment, you get to year 2, and you're just getting the Doctor, and because of the way things work these days, they go, no, I'm going to leave, and then you have to start all over again. But I'm looking forward to Jodie really a lot, because I know she's going to be brilliant.
Yeah, I'm just seeing this beautiful scene up in the clock tower again. I want to speak about it a bit more.
Go on then, because it is beautiful, says, that scene.
Every life I save is a victory. And Clara says, you know, I think you've got the right now to worry about your own life. You've saved all these people. And then he comes back and says, yes, I've been having that argument all my lives. I think that's just so well written by Moffat.
It's great, isn't it? It's great. The whole, you know, the whole fact that this, you know, the youngest sort of Doctor, and he's sort of got the most sort of, you know, life's on his shoulder, he can see all this. And that's the thing about the Doctor. You know, you've got like 13 lives now. And all this time and space sort of adds, like it would to, you know, add sort of worries and things. I just think that line's fantastic.
It's playing the old wizard again, really, isn't it? It could be an actor of any age. It could be a John Hurt. It could be an Alec Guinness back as Obi-Wan. It's how you play that wisdom, you know. I've said about the eyes not convincing people. Perhaps the actors are that old, but, you know, I think it works in the delivery of the writing as well, and the delivery of the actor.
I'll definitely. I think the way Matt says that one line that says everything within that one look he gives to Clark, you don't need really big acting with some people.
Yes, and then we get back to the papal mainframe. Tasha is revealed to have a bit of a stalk in her forehead from a Dalek, which we saw Amy and Rory having, of course, in the beginning of season 7, I think it was, Asylum of the Daleks.
It is that one, yeah. And I think these sort of turn into Dalek things are quite creepy, really. What I love how, you know, the Doctor gets her to fight it, really, and sort of keep her soul on. It's really good.
Is it him sending the TARDIS away this time, or is it an outside force?
I think it's an outside force from the, you know, from the other Time Lords in that crack, I think.
Yes, I think so. And we get that lovely poem you mentioned that Clara's gran reads to her.
Oh, it's just brilliant. That poem is brilliant. I don't know if it's that... I've never actually looked in to find out if that writer is actually a writer of poetry or just wrote that one poem for the Doctor Who.
And you get that sort of Christmas standard argument now about why there's poems in the middle of crackers, don't you? And it's blended in so well to the story.
I know, because, you know, we've always had jokes, you know, a lot of the artisan crackers do have poems these days.
Gran saying, you know, I hope you made a wish, and Jenna doing the crying acting very well.
Well, she does it so well, does it really well, because sometimes it can be too much. Like, though I loved that episode of Holby City last night, there's one actor who really did over-the-top crying, and I think he doesn't need it.
Hooray, the TARDIS is back!
We like that.
And then we get the wonderful scene, the crack seems to be opening, or a little bit brighter than it was.
We can sort of think, is Gallifrey going to come back?
Yeah, we're just sort of wondering how are they going to literally reset all this at the time. And maybe the Doctor wondering if, he's working on a toy, isn't he? And he's wondering if it's Barnable, the young lad who was probably there centuries ago. But he actually hears it's Clara and he drops the thing.
Yeah, there's that great movement when he knows it's Clara back. And it's like, you know, what are you doing here? You know, I said, you know, it's all that sort of argumentative and it turns into brilliance, really.
Yeah, and then he gets a Christmas cracker himself and asks if it's a joke.
Well, it should be a joke. I always think they should be jokes, even though they're terrible at Christmas.
Oh, look, it's Thoughts on a Clock, it's called, and it's about the clock is striking for 11.
11, which he was, you know.
This is a nice joke. Was he actually 12, though? Because of John Hurt, you know?
That's always the interesting ones, because John Hurt... I think they call John Hurt 9.5, don't they?
Yes, and you know, I think I'm buying Matt here looking very old when he's keeping his face still, but when he starts to talk, you know, the cheekiness is there, the youth is there in his eyes.
Yeah, a little bit, I agree. I've sort of, when he doesn't move, it looks very old, but I would agree thinking about the eyes do look young.
And then this lad is coming back. He's calling him Barnable again, twice.
That's great, he isn't Barnable.
Gives Clara a bit of a kiss.
Yes.
And she's going talking to the crack, as you do. And she mentions the L word, love, you know, and if you love him as much as I do,
you will help him out, and they do.
And there we are, a man is now up on the clock tower.
And you get these really loud.
Wondering how the hell's going to happen. Oh, look, something's opening up in the sky.
Oh,
and I love the whole love from Gallifrey thing, and he starts spinning his arms, doesn't he, to shoot the regen out. Energy of the Daleks out of the sky. We get those flying Daleks again from the 50th anniversary.
And really loud. I don't know if you noticed that. That's all. I think Nick Briggs had everything on as loud as possible. They're really loud, those Daleks, and that bit.
Yes, and Murray Gold noticed and turned it up to 11, really, didn't he, on the music?
Yeah, they are seriously loud. I always have to turn that bit down normally because they are very loud Daleks.
And so the Doctor is there. She's now walking into the TARDIS. Mm. All the phone's off the hook. How could that be happening, Al? What could possibly happen with that?
We can't say. unless you've seen Deep Breath, we can't say.
Gotta say, Al, I might not have liked that much about this episode, but I do feel I've liked more as we've got along. But I said at the beginning, this coming scene, I just want to say this, Al, this is still probably my favourite scene in the whole of New Who. Possibly in the whole of Doctor Who.
Really?
Yes, I just think this speech has everything about it. I love the way Jenna plays it. I love the idea of the reset. I love the bow tie dropping to the ground. I just think if the whole episode had been better up to it, you know, it would have been right up there for me. This is my favourite scene in the whole of Who, possibly.
I really, like you, I think that scene where he turns into Peter Capaldi is fantastic.
I've had the music on the iPod in my car and I've often driven to work bored and actually tried to do it in William Hartnell's accent going into Patrick Troughton's, wondering what that would be like. But, you know, you'll never hear that because my impressions are awful, folks.
Yeah, they are. I've heard them and they are awful. So I will say.
No, that's okay.
but there is a... So when that first scene was shot, I had to watch it on the iPlayer because my parents' Skybox decided to move over to whatever she was recording. So it's like, oh, I didn't see it. And then I think I texted you at the time going, what's the costume? Because it flipped over.
And then some... A young ginger girl is running around and the doctor looks up the stairs and there's some legs coming down. And how do you feel about Karen's return? I think it fit in well. I don't think it took too much away from Jenna, really, did it?
I think it's just right. And I think, like, maybe it's not been confirmed, and they do probably the same thing with Gemma for Peter, I think it will work as well.
Yes, the Raggedy Man goodnight.
Yes.
And then, of course, he takes his bow tie off. Fans are wondering how they were going to get rid of the bow tie.
The bow tie was cool.
And the sort of regen, like, I think I would have liked Peter to have got a bit more of stood up energy, but fans have nicknamed it the sneeze regeneration, which is what it is.
It's very quick, isn't it? if you blink, you will miss it. And it goes, like the t-shirt I've got new kidneys. It's like, it's very quick.
And I've been wondering this, you know, having watched a few of the regen episodes lately. Do you get the essence in that first scene, those first few seconds? Do you get the essence of how they play the Doctors in that era? Because I don't think Peter does here. He's just in total shock and surprise.
The staring
is there, the eyebrows are there. Just more or less shock and surprise rather than the attack eyebrows we heard about. Being nicknamed.
I would say yes with Chris Eccleston and David Tennant, but not with Peter, I don't think.
Oh, the whole Barcelona, yeah. It's a bit, you know... The other argument is, are they just playing the last incarnation, you know, they've just come out of in that sort of change? But the fact is, you know, you usually get new directors and new eras, don't you, after the regen, so...
Yeah, it's definitely a new director, like Chris Chignall's doing the last bit for this one. It'll be very interesting to see if it goes the way we think it's going to go.
And then we get, do you happen to know how to fly this thing? And I suppose... Well, is the TARDIS crashing in this point? Because we know it's coughed up by a dinosaur at the end of Deep Breath, so...
That's a very interesting...
At least it hasn't blown up this time, and it looks from that new trailer as though it is going to be exploding again.
I can explain... Well, there's a reason why they blow up the TARDISes. Again, the reason they normally blow up the TARDIS is because it's going from, like... If the last one, it went from normal to HD, and then it's going from HD to 4K. That's why they're blowing up the TARDIS again, I reckon.
Shall we score this one? Are you going to say hit or miss or middling for Time with the Doctor, Matt Smith's farewell story?
I'm probably going to go, because I think it has a good thing. I'll probably go for a middle myself, because I think it has good things, and it has comedy, and it has some fun bits, but it just doesn't, that whole sort of middle central bit doesn't really work with the rest of it, so you're sort of having to hang on to that great bit at the end, really.
Yeah, lovely start for me. The whole comedy, juxtaposition of Clara cooking the turkey and the Doctor up guarding the planet with handles. That's a hit. Several misses after the, I think, possibly just up to the last 20 minutes where we get the lovely scene, as I said, on top of the clock tower. And then it's sort of middling to hit to hit to massive, vast hit. I just love that final scene so much. It is, I'm going to say it again, one of my favourite scenes in the whole history of Doctor Who. So, what can I say? It's very much a slither between a middling and a miss for me. Possibly just into the middling territory, Al.
Yeah, I would agree with that, because it sort of goes up and down like no one's business. I take it was mainly a miss on Twitter on our poll, I take it.
The thing with polls is they only let you do four at a time on Twitter, so I took various ones that...
You can't really get a full opinion, can you?
I did them in broadcast order, so you had a lot of good stories that were broadcast together up against each other.
Yeah,
but this was one of the ones out of the four that got 0%. So I just did a random draw to see, and we decided to do time, and I think 57% were for Day of the Doctor and The Empty Child's Doctor Dances. So we've seen those two
very,
of the top
that's
two.
That's very good, that is.
So what did we do last time, Al? We did...
Riversong.
Yeah, The Husbands of Riversong and this Time of the Doctor one were...
Yeah.
Were both two that had 0% from our votes, Al.
I bet.
So, you know, it's very much hit and miss. Let us know what you think of all these stories, folks. But I was thinking next time, Al, we were going to do our best and our worst. You wanted to choose your best Stephen Moffat, but I think I'd like to do my favourite one as well instead. So we just have a hit special next time.
I think we'll have a hit special because I just love. I'm going to say. So I say what my one is.
Yeah, let them know now, folks.
Yeah, basically, I just love because I've been there. I've been to Versailles, and that is the Girl in the Fireplace, which is the Mad and the Pompadour and the Clockwork Robots David Tennant episode. Because I've been there, and it is a stunning place. I'll go into more detail when we discuss it, but the actual Versailles where they shot it, that one room where the horse comes through the window, is stunning.
Yes, 2006, and I'm going to go to 2010, Al. Massive pressure on the new showrunner and the new actor, new companions. I'm going to do the 11th hour, Al, because that's one of my very favourite Moffat ones, and we're going to be telling you all what we love about those.
Definitely, definitely. I do like that as well.
So a bit of Hughes news, Al, as we record on Friday the 8th of December. A new trailer has just been out in the last few hours. You said you hadn't had a chance to see it yet?
I haven't had a chance to see it, so what's going on in it, basically? Is it, you said there's more, we've mentioned it in the news, there's more sort of regeneration in it, isn't there?
Yes, we see Villengard, which is the planet Captain Jack referred to in The Empty Child Doctor Dances, and the Doctor referred to him being there once and destroying it, he alluded to. We see Bill again, speaking to the Doctor briefly. We see a repeat at the start of the trailer of I'm the Doctor, the original, you might say, that David Bradley tells Peter Capaldi. And we also see them outside a major staircase, a major wide staircase, which I'm wondering about now, Al, because we went to the Series 9 premiere in Cardiff 2 years ago, and there was a sort of imagery scene of the first Doctor on a wide staircase, wasn't there, in that story? I'm reminded of that this morning. I wonder if that's going to be tied in at all.
Oh, yeah, there is, isn't there? There is that sort of one scene. Or is that a maybe staircase where he, you know, goes up or falls down, become Jodie? Maybe there's sort of all that sort of...
Is he going to trip over a brick at last?
Well, maybe, maybe, I think.
No, and we do actually get to see these creatures, enchanted water creatures, which are frozen in time. They look very sort of, if you remember the movie, the early days of CGI, The Abyss, it's sort of a modern take on that sort of thing, what I could see, sort of walking figures.
Well, that'll be interesting, that'll be interesting. Do they work? That's always the thing with sort of frozen, watery things.
But I'm getting so excited about this special now, Al, that, you know, once the hour's done and we've seen Jodie slip into the role, it's going to be another 8 month wait then, isn't it? That's the only thing.
I know, that's always the problem. But it'll be worth it, because I think we're in for something really special this season.
Or could they sneak in an Easter special? They started in November, you know, could they possibly sneak one in?
Well, you wonder, because it's now episode, isn't it, the first episode. Would they put that on at Easter?
But I'd be thinking then, would it lose the momentum? You know, you want a whole run behind it, don't you?
You want a whole run. You want the whole 10 episodes, each one getting better and better, and sort of keeps people going. Well, the problem is, it's always... The problem will probably annihilate that momentum is BBC's scheduling.
Yes, indeed, Al. And on recent episodes, we've let listeners know of a certain, perhaps, book or album or TV show or film we can recommend lately. What's yours at the moment, Al?
What have I been listening, watching? Well, I listened to the new Manic Street Preachers single this morning, which is very good. And I've been watching the A Word and, of course, Peaky Blinders, which is fantastic. Of course, got Star Wars next week, The Last Jedi, that's on the agenda next week. Say again.
Are you going at midnight for Star Wars?
I am going at midnight with my brother, because that's the only screen time at my Odeon what has it in a decent screen. So yeah, I am doing the madness of going at 4 minutes past midnight.
The local View cinema here, I might not get in my seat till about 12:15, because I don't want to be seeing half an hour of adverts at that time of night.
That is true. We worked it out, because you know it's the longest Star Wars film, don't you?
2.5 hours, isn't it?
2.5 hours long. So we've worked out, I think with the adverts, it will finish at about 3, about 3:10, I think.
And recommendations-wise for me, now we're in the mid-season break of Star Trek Discovery. I've gone back and started to watch Enterprise. I'm at the end of season one. I did enjoy that show at the time. It gets a lot of stick from quite a few Star Trek fans.
It's good. I like it.
It's the fact we have, you know, Scott Bakula, who was wonderful in Quantum Leap, that show I can... We'll probably watch over and over all my life, and we
great just got to the episode where
just got to the episode where Al Dean Stockwell guest stars, and it's good to see those two back together again. And they also appeared, I think, together in an episode of NCIS in the last few years.
Yeah, he's just a really good actor. I think there's Enterprise does get a bit of a stomping on because they don't think it's that great. Well, I think there's some really good episodes, and I think their Borg episode was really clever.
Yeah, not got to that one yet, but certainly looking forward to it.
Well, if you remember, it's a really clever Borg episode. I think they get sort of stuck on an ice planet and there's Borg there, and it's a really not over the top Borg episode, but it's a really clever one, I think.
So, Al, next time is going to be a pure Moffat Hits episode. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening, faithful listeners.
Thank you all. Goodbye. Next time on the Target Files podcast, it's the Stephen Moffat Hits, which will be The Girl in the Fireplace, which is my choice, and Mike's choice will be The 11th Hour, both written by Stephen Moffat.
You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files handle, or search Facebook for the podcast page and leave us a message. Thanks for listening. Doctor Who Target Files. Stephen Moffat Hit and Miss Special Part 2 featured Michael Winks and Alexander Gibbons. 12th Doctor Theme, composed originally by Murray Gold. Version 4 of this podcast by Vale Mystery. Please do check out their YouTube channel, VAYLE Mystery. Newsround opening and closing theme, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, Stephen Moffat, Hit or Miss Special Part 2 was recorded in Swansea, Wales, UK and Exeter, Devon, England, UK during December 2017.